room for the season. Even in this beach situation, he did a magnificent job in terms of providing. He would be the cook for these people, plus their friends, and sometimes would even set up like lobster things on the beach, but always in a big style, almost too much. I realized somehow that a sense of proportion was kind of wrong. Then, apparently, they had started on marijuana at the beach, which I learned later because when he became ill, I learned through Mr. Hayes, who was Jay's friend, that they all had been smoking pot. What happened was, I was at work one day, and the phone rang in the morning, and I answered it, and as I recall, it was Jay, and he said, "Hi," and I said, "Hello, how are you? Nice that you should call in the middle of the day. It lends a nice note to the occasion." And he said, "I just called to tell you that I love you, and that I love Judy, and I love her husband, and I love their kids, and I love everybody. But Mom, my head is all mixed up." And I said, "Jay, where are you?" And he said, "I'm with Billy. He is here." This was Mr. Hayes. And I said, "May I speak to Billy, please?" And he put Billy on, and I said, "Billy, what is wrong?" And Billy said, "I don't know, Mrs. Mack, but he really sounds like he is not all together. He has been driving around for a long time. He does not know how long. He has taken something that did not agree with him." And I said, "What are you saying, he has taken something?" And he said, "Well, I think he has taken something that was sold to him. He said he took a lot of it, and the next thing he remembers is that he woke up in the gutter somewhere, and anyway, he is all confused." And I said, "Billy, where are you now?" And he said, "I am at work." And I said, "How did Jay get there?" And he said, "He drove here. He said that he followed the taillights of a truck, and through God's providence, it landed him here." And I said, "I am coming right over." I got the directions. It was somewhere in Brooklyn. He was a garment manufacturer. In fact, I had a tour of his plant while I was there. When I got there, Jay was sitting at a desk, clutching a copy of The Godfather, which apparently he had read, and for some strange reason, had begun to identify with. In other words, all of the stories seemed to him like he was involved in that mafia scene, and he was really very withdrawn. He would answer if asked questions, but they were not too cohesive. He looked frightened. When he did get up and move, he moved near the edge of a wall. So I said to Billy, "The only thing I can do now is call a man who is a professional, who can give me some help. He needs help." I had a friend who was a school psychologist, and I called him and asked if we might have an appointment, and explained that it seems that my son had taken a heavy dose of something and seemed disjointed in his mind, and I would like help. He said the only time he could see us would be the next day, and I asked, "Well, what could I do in the meantime?" And he suggested that we stay with him, like, talk him down if possible, and that he would see him tomorrow. So Mr. Hayes and I took him to a nearby motel. We hired three rooms, Jay being in the middle, and we stayed with him all night. We constantly talked with him. All during the time you could see that he was panicked into the feeling that some impending doom was happening. Something terrible or dreadful was happening. The next day, he got in the car very willingly with me, and we drove out to Long Island where this doctor was. And the doctor took him inside and spoke with him for only 20 or 30 minutes. He then came out and said, "Mrs. Mack, he is sick and should be hospitalized." He then spoke to Jay and told him that his mother was going to take him to a place where they would help him. And Jay said, "No thanks," and got up and ran out of the building and down the street. And I looked at the doctor, and I was crying, and I said, "I just don't know what to do at this point. I am really frightened for him." And he said, "Yes, in fact, he should be picked up, and I will have to call the police." And I said, "Well, if you feel that is wise," and he said, "It is the only thing to do at this point." So he proceeded to call and explain, and gave the description of Jay, and said I could go to the police station if they picked him up and so forth. But I felt that I would like to go out and get him myself. And I got into my car and started driving, and I drove through a few of the main streets, up and down. And finally, at an intersection, I saw several cars stopped, and I stopped my car because I recognized Jay. There were several cops around him, and they had him in handcuffs. And I walked over, and of course a crowd was gathering, and Jay was standing there trying to resist being arrested, which seems understandable because he was really distressed and frightened out of his mind. So in order to try and quiet him, I put my hands up on his chest and said, "Jay, we are not trying to hurt you. You do need help. Please understand that. We are your friends." And at that point, he took his handcuffed hands, broke out of the grip of the policeman, and came down and knocked my hands off his chest. And the police sort of stepped back and said, "See that? He even hit his mother." Then he was getting slightly more resistive to the police after he had struck me, decided that he was a real rough one, and they were all wrestling with him with his hands behind his back in handcuffs. Now Jay was a very large person, and he had very large hands and wrists, so it was difficult for them, and when they put the handcuffs on, he was really upset. I asked the policeman if they would help me get him to the private psychiatric hospital, and they said, "No way." They said once the police are involved, he goes to a police station, and a staff psychiatrist is called and examines the person, and if he deems it necessary, he goes to the state mental hospital in central Islip. So they asked me to please follow them over to the police station, and I did. And when he got there, he was mute, he wasn't talking, and he wasn't reacting anymore. And all of a sudden, he rolled on the floor, like went off the side of the chair and kept saying, "The handcuffs are killing me." And then he started to cry and said, "The reason is, I am afraid of dying. I thought I was going to die." Then one of the policemen said, "My God, I used to go to school with him, Mrs. McDonald. What happened to him?" At that point, we waited for the psychiatrist, and it was very quiet. And I explained to him that he was not going to die. He was healthy and well, and we were going to help him. We would have to go from here to a hospital. And I asked him if he understood that, and he said he did. We waited, and the psychiatrist came, and of course, he had to be hospitalized. So they took him to Central Islip, and it is probably now 11 or 12 o'clock at night. A psychiatrist began to talk to him there and said, "Do we really need to keep the handcuffs on?" And the cop said, "You don't know how strong he is. It took a lot of us to get him down to the ground." But the doctor said, "I trust him. He seems calm now. Let's give it a go." And they took the handcuffs off. And then the doctor said to the cops, "It's all right. We'll keep him. You can go." And they left. And then we sat and talked, and the psychiatrist probed with me into some of the background. And I explained that the death of his father had been very disturbing to Jay, and he had never, in a sense, shown in a way like his deep emotional feeling. Like he was, again, trying to hide it. It was difficult, perhaps, for him, because in our household, like, there was this bit about a stiff upper lip kind of thing that even I, perhaps, could not help him to be able to show his emotions. Now, when Mr. Hayes, Jay, and I were at the motel, I had phoned Jeff, realizing it was probably putting a burden on him, but I personally felt that I did not have a husband, and I wanted to talk to somebody who had good sense, and also because I knew that he would be concerned. I called Fort Bragg, and when the phone was answered, it was answered by Colette, and I explained that I did not mean to upset her in any way, but that I called to speak to Jeff because we were having a little problem with Jay. And she said he was not there. He was on maneuvers or special detail down in Puerto Rico, but she wanted me to tell her about it, so I said, "Well, Colette, I think Jay has probably taken a bad dose of something, and he seems a little out of his mind right now, and I am getting professional help for him. But I just wanted to talk to Jeff because he had such a quiet, nice mind that what he can do is ease me a little bit. But it's not necessary, and please don't burden him with it." And she said, "You know Jeff, he loves Jay and he would be very concerned, and I think he should know." I learned later that Colette got permission to call through on the field telephone where he was on maneuvers. He then got special permission to leave Puerto Rico and come up. He arrived, to my recollection, the very next day. "What was he dressed in?" Victor Warheide asked. He was dressed in his full military garb. You know, a green beret wears his beret, and he wears a uniform, and he has boots on. Did he bring any other clothing with him? Well, interestingly enough, I can only remember him in the uniform for the entire time he stayed there. In fact, even when we visited Jay at the hospital, which was several times, and Jeff spoke to the psychiatrist many times, he was always dressed in his military garb. Jeff told me that he reviewed with Jay how it happened, who gave it to him, and the answer was always that it was just some guy who was selling the stuff. Then Jeff was discussing the fact that Jay was mostly concerned with impending death because he had watched his father die. He was with him during the last hour. Was Jeff there also? No, Jeff was in Chicago. And the thing that distressed Jay was the absence of color in the body following death, plus the fact that there was excretion, probably semen or urine, which is a very natural thing, but to him it was frightening. He had never talked about this to anyone, but he was able to relate it to Jeff, and Jeff explained the process of death to him. Now, on the day following, Jeff asked the doctors how they thought Jay was doing, and they said they did not think he was psychotic, but that he'd had a very bad drug reaction. And he said, "We think we should be able to release him tomorrow, but we must caution you that he is going to have bad flashbacks, and we have him on Thorazine at this time, and he should be maintained on Thorazine, and he should get this kind of dosage, and so forth. And if he gets in trouble occasionally, if he gets the same feelings, and we have discussed this with him, he should not panic, that it will probably pass, but he should be maintained on Thorazine." At that point, they told us we could come for him the next day, and we took him home, and Judy had prepared a lovely supper. She had things cheerful and nice. Jeff said it was time for him to go, and what they would do was go back to New York, and then Jeff would take off from New York to return back to his base, but he would see that Jay got back okay. He wanted to see where it was that he worked, and that was the last time I saw them as brothers together, when they left to return to New York. Was Jeff ever violent? Did he ever, in your presence, strike anybody? No. I mean, as kids, he and his brother would wrestle occasionally, things like that. But no. I think Jeff dislikes disorder or chaos or violence or disruption. He is by nature a lover of beauty and harmony and peace. I think most people find him to be a delightful person to know. I have never known him to be abusive. He likes to keep things serene. As a result, his nature as a baby, he was, you know, the kind of kid that even when he woke up from his sleep, he had a grin from ear to ear. I must confess that I thought he was kind of a little slow mentally at first because he was just so happy all the time. He had a wonderful, sunny disposition, and he was a very amenable child. Responded, like for instance at Christmas, in order to make it look like you were getting a lot of things, you'd slip in things that were absolutely needed, such as a flannel shirt, or underwear, or whatever. And when he opened his presents, he was always very enthusiastic. You know, "Just what I wanted." And you'd laugh because it might be two sets of underwear. It was like a filler present, you know. But still he responded to it. He was always, he had joy, and he brought joy to lots of other people. Moorhide then asked about the relationship between Jeff and Colette. "Like every couple," she said, "there were times when I'm sure they were a little hassled, but it didn't seem to be anything. They looked like they were truly very much in love." Now, when you were visiting them at Thanksgiving in 1969, I take it Colette knew she was pregnant again? Apparently. What was her reaction? She seemed very pleased. Now, I was a little upset, I must tell you. I didn't say this to her, but I felt that because of the difficulty of her pregnancies, that, you know, it was kind of, you know, maybe they ought to at least give her more time. But she always wanted a large house with a lot of children, dogs, and horses. I mean, it was sort of a dream of both of them, to be able to live in a place, like, they often talked about living in Vermont or someplace of that nature, where they could enjoy, in a sense, a natural existence. you know, space, children, and animals. So when I embraced Colette and asked how she felt about it, she said, "I am very happy. I know that it will be okay. It is probably a little soon, but it will be okay." When you visited at Thanksgiving, where did you sleep?
I slept with Kimberly.
Was it Kim's idea that you sleep in bed with her?
Yes.
We had kind of a special thing. Kim and I always, we kind of looked at each other and grinned. I can't describe it to you otherwise, but when I came, it was always, "Nana, you know you sleep with me." Dorothy MacDonald then, for the first time, lost her composure to the extent that she began to sob. When Victor Warheide resumed his questioning, his inexorable, inevitable, unavoidable questioning, his voice was unusually soft. "Was there any problem as far as bedwetting was concerned?" he asked. "I don't think Kimberly was bedwetting any longer, but I'm not sure of that. I didn't live with him that long."
"When was the next time you went down there?"
"Just prior to New Year's."
"How were they getting along?"
"To me, it seemed very much the same."
"Any problems? Any tensions?"
"If there were tensions, they were not obvious. There was no overt fighting. The conversation was normal and routine. I remember what we did. New Year's Eve, we went for dinner with a group of people, and I went home early and relieved the babysitter, and they stayed out to dance. To my observation, it looked like a normal, happy married couple who were having a New Year's Eve out with friends."
"Did you ever help around the kitchen at all?"
"Oh, yes. At Thanksgiving or even the next time, yes, I would always be helping. Either setting the table or helping with the meal. I remember inadvertently I had thrown away the makings of gravy for little meatballs that Colette was preparing for hors d'oeuvres, and I felt very badly about it. But I told her, 'Hey, kid, don't sweat it, because I have a little secret recipe that I can sort of concoct.' And I got out some gravy mix and some onion soup and, well, you know, put together a gravy base and put the meatballs in it, and kiddingly I said to her, 'It'll be the hit of the show.' She said, 'Okay, I'm glad we were able to recover.' And so we put out all these hors d'oeuvres for the people, and it was satisfying, and she laughed and said, 'You've done it again.'"
"Do you remember that they kept things like popsicles in the freezer for the kids?"
"Oh yes, that would be a common thing for them to do."
"Well, do you remember specifically any of the household utensils? Speaking of, for example, an ice pick?"
"Sir, I've gone over in my mind a million times. May I answer that?"
"I can't.
I would not be able to identify anything."
"Well, in the freezer, things have a tendency to frost up. Do you remember using an ice pick?"
"I had no time. Not no time. I had no occasion to use one, to my recall."
"Do you remember when they were preparing drinks, let's say at Thanksgiving, that Jeff went around looking for an ice pick? As a matter of fact, he went out into a shed in the back to look for an ice pick."
"That could very well be true, sir, but I have no recalls of that."
"When you visited at Thanksgiving and New Year's, did Jeff say anything about having some connection with a boxing team, working out with a boxing team?"
"I think there was some discussion of it, but it's not a strong memory of mine. In other words, I know that he was always involved in some kind of sport or other. He was also a trooper, a paratrooper. He was jumping. I went to see one of his jumps with Colette and the children and that kind of thing. You know, we spent time talking or watching him do things of this nature. He would play ball."
"Do you recall him saying anything about taking a trip with the boxing team?"
"There was some discussion."
"Yes, you're right. There was some discussion about that."
"Do you know where he was planning to go?"
"Oh, boy. Would Russia sound ridiculous?"
"No, it does not sound ridiculous.
I just sort of had this mental flash, but it sounded like so far out."
"Did Colette have any comment to make on this proposed trip to Russia?"
"I think she was, again, like hoping that there wouldn't be a long absence. I must say probably there was some concern on her part
because, of course, he had been absent a fair degree of the time because of his workload and his internship and so forth. But by the same token, she understood that he had this, like, sort of desire to participate and be, in a sense, an outstanding person. No matter what he did, he was always trying to, you know, do a good job, that kind of thing. Did Colette have any reason to be jealous? If she did, she never mentioned it to me, sir. Okay? That's as fair as I can be with you. She might have been the type of woman that felt that way and would not discuss it with his parent. I do not know. Whether justified or not, did Colette think she had any reason to be jealous of Penny Wells? Sir, you're asking me something that I have never heard discussed. Well, I'm going to ask you specifically. When Jeff was up there about September or October, when Jay had this problem which caused him to be hospitalized, did Jeff have an occasion to look up Penny Wells, spend any time with her? If he did, sir, it was without my knowledge. All right, now, on February 17th, and in the days immediately thereafter, did you question your son in any way about any of the details of what had happened inside that apartment? No. And may I emphasize that I was the mother of a young man whose wife and children were murdered, and my concern was to give solace and to try and help him bear this agonizing burden. I did not question him. You stayed down there during that entire week? Yes, sir. But my time was not always spent with Jeff. I had a few other things that I had to take care of. What things are you referring to? Well, I got a telephone call from Mr. Hayes, and he said that Jay wanted to talk to me. And I spoke to Jay on the telephone, and Jay sounded like he wasn't himself again, as though he might have been having one of those things that the doctors called a flashback. And he asked me, "Mom, tell me what is happening." And I told him, and he sounded like he was a little disjointed. And I said to him, "Where are you now?" And he said, "I am with Billy." And I asked Jay if he would be kind enough to let me speak to Billy, which he did. And I said to Billy, "Jay sounds ill." And Billy said, "I'm afraid to tell you, Mrs. McDonald, that he really is not well again, and I honestly don't know what to do." And I said to Billy, "You know the hospital that he went to before, and my only request is that if you feel he is not manageable, perhaps they will be able to help. Undoubtedly, it is a flashback, or to your knowledge, has he done anything stupid, like taking drugs again?" And Billy said, "It is possible, I don't know, but he is getting messages out of the TV again, which is one of the symptoms of his trouble before." And I said, "Well, the messages he is getting today from the TV are very real, but I am sure that he can't keep them in perspective." So I said, "Billy, I can't be in two places at the same time, and right now I really feel as though I cannot leave North Carolina." So I asked Billy, "Can you talk to him and see if he will voluntarily go with you back to the hospital?" And Billy said, "Okay, I will try, Mrs. Mack." And I believe he called me back later that night to inform me that they had been successful in convincing Jay, not with ease, that he should return to the hospital. The next day, late that night after having visited Jeff, I got this message that I would have to call the hospital because something was wrong with Jay. So I called, and they assured me, now this was probably close to midnight on the 18th, as I recall, that Jay was sound asleep. He had been tranquilized, and he was fine. And I told the people on the phone that I was confused because the message indicated there had been some trouble. And they said, "Well, Mrs. McDonald, there was trouble earlier. Apparently, during the night he awoke, and he did not know where he was, and he became very deranged, and he put his fists through the window and said that he needed to get out and he had to get down to see what was going on. But they said they gave him heavy dosages of Thorazine and it tended to quiet him down. And now he was resting and, in fact, fast asleep." How long did Jay remain in the hospital? Isn't it true that he was at the funeral service? Yes. That was because our family has this marvelous friend, Mr. Robert Stern, from New Hope, Pennsylvania. And when he heard Jay was in difficulty, he contacted a doctor in Bucks County and explained the situation and arranged for private, follow-up care, and for Jay to live with his family, because he had known Jay almost all his life, and the next day it was arranged for Jay to be released in his custody when it was decided that Jay was now manageable, and Mr. Stern took Jay from the hospital down into the village to remove his clothing from the place where he was staying and took him back to Bucks County, to his own home. On the following day, Mr. Stern felt it was imperative that Jay be present at the service so that his presence would support the family, and so there would be no conjecture as to why the brother was not there. So he flew down in his company plane, bringing Jay, and then went back on the plane to Bob's home. The day after the internment in Long Island, I drove to Bucks County and spent probably a good part of that day talking with the psychiatrist who Mr. Stern had arranged for, trying to establish some background, and then I drove back on down to Fort Bragg. Now, after Jeffrey was released from the hospital, did you and he have occasion to take a short trip together? Yes, as I recall, the wife of his commanding officer met me one day in the lobby of the place where I was staying and suggested that I take him to the seashore for a bit, just for a few days' recovery. I asked Jeff if he would like to go, and he said yes, and we did go. And he just walked the seashore, and we picked up shells and had breakfast. And I remember just driving around, seeing the countryside, and trying to restore. But on my honor, I never probed. I could not ask questions. I felt that other people had. You didn't probe, and he didn't volunteer, right? That's correct. Now, after the charges were dropped, Warheide said, why didn't your son remain on the East Coast? Doesn't he have connections on the East Coast? Yes, sir, in a sense, but they're almost all painful. His father is gone, his grandmother is gone, his wife and children, primary, are gone. Even his house is gone. There is nothing there. But isn't it strange that he moved from one edge of the continent all the way out to the other? At the time, you must remember, he was working very hard to get his life together, and he did work in New York for 6 months, and believe me, when you see what it is like to live in New York City, I don't think it is the ideal situation. It isn't a spot that either he or even Colette would have wanted to be. In other words, it was not their lifestyle. So when Jeff and I discussed it, I encouraged him to go. This is something that if you think will help restore your spirits, because the sun does shine, and if the people are kind, and if you can be engaged in the work of your interest, why not? Well, it seems to me that he might want to stay around to occasionally visit the graves. Let me tell you something. I don't even visit those graves. I did very consistently in the very early years, but I found that after a while, first of all, the memory of the children, and that includes Colette, because essentially she was my child. The memory is very pure and very good, and I would like to keep it that way. I don't mind putting flowers on the graves, but I don't want to enter into a competition. What do you mean by that? Mr. Warheide, I am not casting aspersions, but it is true that Mr. and Mrs. Kassab keep those flowers fresh, and there are multiple baskets of flowers, and they are never left to wilt or die. Their visits there are continuous, but by the same token, it seems like a show, and I will tell you why. Beside those bodies lies the body of her husband, and there is no tombstone or name commemorating him. This may sound harsh, and I pass no judgment, but as you know, I am sure that man committed suicide, and Mildred could not ever forgive this. As a result, she will not honor him by even putting his name there. This, as it happens, was not true. There was, and is, a marker at the grave of Coles Stevenson. Please let me clear some of these things up right now. The fact that there was a great deal of attention paid to the girls' graves was pleasing at first, and then I realized that in a sense it was symbolic, as though they were keeping alive more than the memory of the death of the children. It was mostly for attention to be brought to this thing. Now, for the loss of three lives, attention must be paid. But it seems to me not in this showy way. So I feel that if that is how they spend their time, and since I, for about a year and a half, have felt that it would be impossible for me to continue visiting or meeting them on the basis that their attitude toward Jeff had changed, then you will have to forgive me when I tell you that I prefer to have the thoughts of my children in my mind rather than in flowers placed on a grave where there are already too many placed.
That is very interesting, Victor Warheide said. Tell me, Mrs. MacDonald, why do you think the Kassabs, who were so supportive of your son, suddenly changed their mind about him?
In the dynamics of human behavior, one has to stop and wonder why attitudes change. Now, let me start from the beginning as I see it.
By all means, do so.
Frequently, I have heard the story over and over again from both Mildred and her sister Helen, that Mildred was the youngest and the prettiest, and therefore a lot of attention was paid to making sure that Mildred's life was filled with gaiety and good things. She was given the opportunity that the older sisters and the parents worked towards giving her, and she herself was almost prepared to sort of be on stage. In all sincerity, the woman has had a tough time because there have been tragedies in her life. But every time something happened, it always seemed to, you know, she is a little lady, but a very powerful lady, and the power is in that she shuts out more. In other words, she has the power, I think, to change her temperament. Now what happens is that when her husband died, and this is foreign to my lifestyle, she was a lady who traveled in the more elite set in Patchogue. We were with other kinds of people. They were good people from all walks of life, but Mildred was very selective about professional people. When her husband died, the concern in the family was for Mildred. So they gathered together and they sent her on a world tour of 1 year. And when she returned, they then established her in a hotel in New York for 6 months. And they gleefully talk about how she was set up in the best table in the dining room night after night to attract the attention of wealthier people, because obviously they would be in that vicinity. Now, this is not hearsay. This is what is being told me over and over again. And eventually she did attract the attention of one Alfred Kassab, who is by all means a reasonably attractive man. His family was wealthy. He came from the South, as I understand, and he and Mildred were genuinely attracted to each other. I am not disputing that. And then they got married. And when they got married, and this was told me over and over again by that family, Freddie's mother was insane with rage and decided that she would cut him out of her will. And because of this, Mildred and Freddie, mostly Mildred, would talk incessantly to me about how they were going to work to declare her mother incompetent at the time of that will, because they wanted their rightful share, and they were accustomed also, of course, to money. Again, this may sound a little too strong, but there were times, sir, in her conversation, when everything looked very good, and we were all together, and there was no tragedy yet. There were times when my feeling was that their concern was much more for Jeff than for Colette. Mildred tended to apologize for Colette. I found her to be an entrancing girl. Sometimes she looked a little harassed, but it was mostly, I felt, that she felt she wasn't managing very well. I was aware of her faults, and they made us understand each other better. But by the same token, I really feel that one of the things that made everything okay in their eyes was the fact that Jeff was going to be a doctor. I have a feeling that they felt very well protected by the fact that there was going to be someone to lean on. Now, that may sound severe, harsh, or whatever, but I honestly feel that when Jeff made the decision to move to California, that was the beginning of their disenchantment. Also, let me tell you that from day one, February 17th, when we arrived, Mr. Kassab made some really strong statements about how he was going to pursue this case down to the end of his days. And I realize that we all handle our grief and our anger in different ways, and this statement by itself is an understandable one. But by the same token, he also feels he has to, like, prove this to his wife, who is the one behind him, like making the spitballs, and he is throwing them. I really think he has been pressured in this way. When was it that you first traveled to California and visited your son? War Heidi asked. I went probably in August of the first year when he was there. I went again in February. This would have been within days of February 15th, the evening on which Freddie Kassab had spent 2 hours explaining to Dorothy MacDonald how he'd come to believe her son guilty of murder. I felt that was probably going to be a bad time for him, as it is for all of us always. Always Christmas and February are very bad. What is his lifestyle out there? Well, he works very hard, and that has sort of been the story of his life. He does socialize. He entertains at home a great deal, because that has always been a style of his life. He has always been a good host. He has a boat. I've enjoyed being on it. It is a very refreshing experience to be back on the water. That, again, was part of our lifestyle. So you feel he had adjusted well to California?
Yes, and I remember being very impressed by it myself. It was sunny, the people were kind, traffic seemed to flow in a nice way, and things seemed logical. Roads led somewhere. In other words, they have better... It just seemed to me that people were very nice. There was a calm approach to life. There was a joyfulness. People looked healthy. People seemed to be tan, brown, kind. I was depressed, and it appealed to me. So I went back and actually looked for a little house and found one, and felt that it would be nice to be able to retire here, because you could pull in with a car to a station, and you have a knock on your motor, the man would raise the hood and he'd fix it, and you'd say, "How much do I owe you?" And he would say, "For what? 15 minutes? And I think, this is a whole new way of life. It was really very pleasing.
Well, since he's been in California, has he talked to you at all about the night of February 16th and 17th, or does he just put that out of his mind and talk about other things?
I think we talk about the pain of loss. But apart from the time when he testified before the Article 32 hearing, that's about the only time that he sat down in your presence and told the whole story. That is correct, sir. And I've never probed. I'm sure that some people think that may be very strange, but I felt there were enough people asking questions, and that I, in a sense, you know,
since the FBI and the CID were asking questions, it was superfluous on your part?
It seemed to be that there were people who were asking questions. Mrs. MacDonald, before we close, do you have any comments that you wish to make to the grand jury? If there is something I haven't inquired into that you think should be brought to their attention.
No, except I am sorry that they have been imposed upon, because I feel that essentially we've been through a grand jury hearing before.
Well, this is not an imposition, Mrs. MacDonald. There are 3 dead people.
I understand that very well.
The Philadelphia psychologist who had administered the tests to Jeffrey MacDonald in 1970, and who had found no sign of either psychosis or psychopathic tendencies, was called to testify. Victor Warheide asked first how it had come about that he had been called upon to examine MacDonald. In a rather unusual way, the psychologist said, the defense attorney, in an effort to help prepare a potential defense, requested that Captain MacDonald be examined by a forensic psychiatrist in Philadelphia, with whom I had worked on previous occasions. The purpose, as I understood it, was to show that he was not mentally ill. The crime apparently was of such a nature, as it was explained to me, that it was highly likely that someone who was fairly disturbed would have committed it. And one line of reasoning that the defense was pursuing was to show that Captain MacDonald was not so disturbed. So I was not being asked to examine him to determine whether he was not guilty by reason of insanity or anything like that, but simply to see if there was any sign of emotional illness or maladjustment, or what his potential for extreme violent behavior was. How many days did you see him?
Only on one day.
Is this the ideal procedure?
I would prefer to see a subject over several days. But in this case, I remember that there was a great hurry about getting the whole thing done, and the subject could not be provided over several days.
I assume that in conducting the type of examination you conducted, you first have to establish a certain rapport with the subject?
Yes.
And the difficulty in establishing rapport with someone like this is to initially convince him that you are indeed working for his defense. I mean, you have to reassure him that it is important he explain himself as frankly and openly as possible. It was particularly difficult in this case, because Captain MacDonald was a very intellectualizing fellow. He thought things out a lot in his head, and was always anticipating and worrying and concerned about what might happen next, and what would be the results of what he would say. I suppose that's sort of an appropriate concern, but it stood in the way of getting him to open up, frankly. So I spent some time with him, pointing out that what he told me, he was telling me in confidence, that the information would be communicated only to his attorney and the psychiatrist employed by his attorney, and that it was very important that he discuss things with me as frankly and openly as possible. He was concerned because he said the incident was very much on his mind, and he was afraid that the fact that it was would influence his test results and might suggest that he had committed the crime. I said, on the contrary, if he attempted to keep such information out, it would certainly look as if he were being evasive. As we went into the examination, it seemed fairly clear that he had taken my advice. His responses were quick. They did not suggest that he was being carefully reflective, thinking ahead of what he was going to say. He showed no indications, in other words, of planning ahead in what he was saying and trying to make himself look good. Instead, he seemed to be speaking quickly, openly, frankly, and without reserve. Now, can you tell us what your general observations were with respect to Captain MacDonald? Besides his concern that his preoccupation with what had happened might influence the test results, what struck me first was that he was the sort of person who initially comes across as very self-possessed. This is a man who doesn't turn to other people for help with his problems. This is a man who can work things out for himself. So he denies any emotional difficulties, any complaints. Many individuals, if you ask, "Have you ever had any problems of getting along?" would say, "Well, occasionally, yes." Captain MacDonald tended not to do that. He seemed to be the sort of person, if you came up to him on the street at any time, he would tell you things are going fine. He seemed quite naive psychologically. Some people with no training or education are very sensitive and quick to think in psychological terms and know how people are thinking and feeling. He was not this sort of person. In spite of the fact that he had completed college and medical school, he was not an insightful. He was a very bright person, but not a person who understood how the mind works and how people think. He was really quite dumb in that regard. He seemed to come across as a person who had very little understanding of his own behavior. And this made me feel that more than most people, Captain MacDonald would not be very good at subtly or cleverly or consistently hiding features about his personality. He was too naive to do that. You know, if you have any smarts psychologically, and a psychologist asks you, "Do you have any problems at all?" you know you are not supposed to say, "Oh, no, doc, no problems at all." You're supposed to say, "Well, yeah, you know, like anybody, I have occasionally." He didn't have that kind of smarts. It made me feel that this was a person who was not going to have the sophistication to evade things cleverly. Once he actually began the tests, his responses were very quick, almost impulsive. There was no indication whatsoever that he was trying to conceal or hide things that came up. In fact, in the actual content of his test responses, material came up that was clearly related to the incident. And so, overall, there was certainly no indication whatsoever that he was attempting to conceal his thoughts about the deaths or to convince me in any way of his innocence. And the overall results, just looking at the whole works, falls broadly within normal limits. In other words, there is no particular thing on any of the tests that jumps out at you as a strikingly abnormal finding. On the MMPI, for example, there is one scale that approaches the abnormal range, but doesn't quite get there. You and I probably have ones that approach the abnormal range and don't get there either. might even have a few over it, which may or may not mean anything. Actually, the fact that they are all within normal limits is in itself unusual. Of all the people that I have ever seen who have been accused of violent crimes, it's pretty unusual that, I suppose because in most instances, even on the cases where they've been found not guilty, they had an adjustment such that there was reason to believe that they might have done it. In other words, there were some abnormal features in their adjustment. Now, the main thing that came across about Captain McDonald is that basically this guy, and if you talk to him, you're going to find this hard to believe, basically, this guy is a very passive, dependent guy with marked feelings of inadequacy. But this is all concealed by a surface where he presents himself as adequate, competent, in control, perfectly well-adjusted, and always at ease and ready to handle whatever comes up. So there is this sort of shell of adequacy or competency. But inside, these marked feelings of not being assertive enough, not being adequate, having real doubts about himself. And all this is very much unconscious. Like if you asked him, well, underneath, you really are sort of worried about yourself, huh? You would really get him up in the air because he would say, what do you mean? He might get threatened if he worried about you, but if you were a person that he could sort of put down, he would have no hesitation to say, what are you talking about? So it's this contrast between the way he presents himself and what comes across unconsciously as you begin to spend time with him and test him and talk with him and work with him. For example, on the MMPI, the highest scale, the one that's approaching the abnormal range, is the masculinity femininity scale. And he is scoring rather in the feminine direction, which doesn't mean homosexuality or anything like that. But men who score in the feminine direction are men who are usually somewhat passive, not terribly direct or assertive. People who, when they are angry or upset, would express their feelings in somewhat more passive ways. They might, for example, be sarcastic rather than directly argumentative. To give you another example, here's a TAT story. He sees a picture of a boy looking at a violin, and he is asked to tell the story about it. Generally, on all the TAT stories, you say, tell me what led up to what is going on now, how it comes out, and how the people are thinking and feeling. Okay, it's just a boy looking at a violin. It's purposely made, so you can't say exactly what's going on. You have to make it up. Now, he says, this is a little boy who is getting ready to practice his violin. He didn't have to say little boy. Why did he use the word little? He's getting ready to practice his violin. He's a little annoyed. Okay, now, some of you probably would see this boy as annoyed. Some of you might see him as pleased. But for Captain McDonald, this boy is a little annoyed. He'd rather be doing something else. He's had it a number of months and is barely adequate. Now, where is that coming from in this picture? He's had it a number of months and is barely adequate. I'm trying to present this in a way that is pretty straightforward, you know. One can dwell on psychoanalytic interpretations of this material and see the violin as a symbol for the male sexual organ and all this sort of thing. But that's getting pretty hot and heavy. And I think the point gets across without getting into all of that. He'll give up other things to practice it. Now what's going on here? He's annoyed. He's barely adequate. He isn't really liking it, but he will give up other things to practice it. After much discussion with the parents, one-sided from the parents' viewpoint, he practices it for a number of years and then gives it up. He thinks there are nicer things to do with his time than something that doesn't fit in with his idea of the role of a young male. Now the point about this story is there's nothing strikingly aberrant about it. He doesn't say that the boy is going to take the violin and set it on fire or anything like that. It's not wildly abnormal, but it does reveal certain things about his personality adjustment. He clearly attempts to present himself as a strong, competent man, but his underlying dependency needs require him to gain the approval of those in authority over him, an approval that he gains by conformity. So on the one hand, you've got a guy who wants to be strong, competent, and independent, but on the other, he wants everybody to approve of what he does. Basically, he is this passive guy with doubts about his adequacy, but he wants to be seen as strong and competent. He is really worried about what people are going to think. In other words, despite his assertions of well-being and independence, these mutually contradictory needs of being independent and autonomous on one hand and gaining approval on the other can't lead him to any real independence. As long as he is caught in that bind, he's never really going to become a completely mature individual. Now, there are probably a lot of people in the world that, by this definition, are not completely mature individuals. So I don't mean to say that this constitutes some markedly abnormal feature. But the crux, the irony of his situation, is that to the extent that he gains this approval from authority that he needs by conforming, to the same extent he loses his sense of adequacy and strong masculine identity. In other words, if you've got any insight, you know that every time you submit and go along with what authorities are saying, you're losing that much of your own independence and integrity. How do you handle that? Well, he handles it by not having insight. Other people might handle it differently. Some people might develop tics or stomach pains. The key thing about Captain McDonald is that he handles his conflicts by denying that they exist. He puts a little part of himself over here and a little part of himself over there, and he never puts it all together. And as long as he doesn't put it together, it doesn't upset him. So, you or I might look at Captain McDonald in a brief conversation and think, how can he hide from his feelings like that? Well, I'll tell you how. If he didn't hide from his feelings like that, he would be every day confronted with the fact that on one hand he's saying he's a strong, successful male, and on the other hand, he is bowing down to authority and giving in to people, and he wouldn't be able to handle it. As a result, he handles it by completely hiding from his feelings. He is a guy who is simply not in touch with his feelings. It's a crucial part of his personality adjustment that he does not understand what's going on in him. He has no insight. In his interview with me, he said, "You know, what bugs me about all this, people keep phoning and wanting to give me sympathy about what's happened, like they want me to cry on their shoulder. I'm not going to cry on anybody's shoulder." Now, if you're going to be charged with a crime, you probably shouldn't have this kind of adjustment, because it doesn't look good when people come around and you don't look upset. But there is no way in the world that a person with Captain McDonald's personality adjustment is going to look upset in the presence of people, because that would indicate that he has some feelings. It would indicate that he can understand what is going on inside himself, and that would open up all sorts of problems for a person with his adjustment. Now, another thing is, I think, really, as you begin to spend time with Captain McDonald, you begin to see that he's got a nostalgic longing for his early childhood. All of this that we're talking about, of course, is pretty much pushed under consciousness. But when you hear him talk about his boyhood, he clearly seems to regret the loss of his early, dependent, conforming role. Then, he knew how to win approval and respect. He was a bright, good student. He was athletic. He knew how to do all kinds of things that would win approval and attention. You know, the glowing schoolboy. Perfect. That was it for him. Well, what do you do when you're this bright, accepting schoolboy? You conform. You do all the right things to win the adulation of your parents and teachers. But what do you do when you grow up? How does a person with his image of himself as a young, successful, bright student athlete handle becoming an adult? Let's look at another picture. It's a picture of a man climbing a rope. He says, "A gymnast showing off, climbing the rope in gym to the delight of others. Jesus, how do you make a story out of this? He feels silly that he has to show off to amuse his friends." You see, if you're a good, young, bright, athletic kid, you don't feel silly. But when you get to be an adult, other feelings start to creep in. He says, he'd rather have the attention in another way, but he is the center of the party and continues to do it to keep his large number of friends nearby laughing. Afterwards, he always feels foolish, but the next time the occasion arises, he does the same thing again. He will continue to entertain people, each time feeling it really isn't him doing it. He'd rather sit down and talk to a friend than perform, but he will continue because of his fear of losing friends. So he's stuck. The only way Captain MacDonald can handle it is not to consciously recognize this conformity and need for approval as a subjection of himself. And as long as he can do that, he can continue to view himself, particularly in regard to his professional competence as a doctor, as an incipient surgeon, and the esteem and approval that he gains by that, as an indication of his adequacy as a man. How would that affect his family situation, so far as his wife and two children are concerned? Victor Warheide asked. He would be a guy who would lose himself in his work. His contact with any potentially intimate human relationships, particularly his wife and children, would be marked with reserve and handicapped by his conflicts about independence and dependence. This is a guy, for example, who would be appalled at the thought of woman's lib, because the authority, if so many people start questioning his authority, that's going to be a problem for him. That isn't unusual. There are a lot of people like that. But this is the way he is, too. He would probably be able to be most intimate with people where the lines of authority and structure are most clear. And of course, that's only true in a marriage if your wife willingly subjugates herself to you. He was able to express what warmth he was able to express much more easily with his children than he was with his wife. And occasionally in the tests, a sort of nostalgic quality would come out in regard to his children. As at one point he saw in the Rorschach on card 5, he saw the upper details as the head of a bunny rabbit. "I see a bunny rabbit," he said. "We gave one to Kimmy about a month before this occurred." The whole idea of the bunny rabbit, this is sort of the softest, pleasantest type of response he gives on the tests. And even then he didn't make it as soft and pleasant as he could, because he emphasized, "It looks like the bunny rabbit because of the form, the ears coming up, the feet coming down." He might have said, for example, "It looked like a bunny rabbit because it looked soft and furry," which would be sort of a warmer, more affectionate type of response. But he didn't do that. So even at that level, he can't let his defenses down that much. He instead sort of emphasized the hard line, the edge, the form that creates the perception of the bunny rabbit. You see, on the Rorschach, we show people a series of these ink blots, and the person tries to say what they are. And one of the ways we score the test is to go back over it once we've gone through all the cards and say, "What about the blot made you see it that way?" People see different things for different reasons. Some will say, "Well, it was just shaped like that," or, "Well, it has sort of a soft, textury quality that makes it look like that," or, "Well, it seemed like they were moving," or, "Well, the color made it look like that." When you pull all these things together and add up the totals, one of the things we look at in scoring the Rorschach is the extent to which a person tends to use one or another determinant: color, texture, movement, shape, form, all of these things. And there is a tendency for certain sorts of mental states to be associated with a tendency to use certain sorts of determinants. For example, people who are intellectualizers will tend to use human movement often as a determinant of what they see. People who are very emotion-laden often tend to be much more responsive to the colors. Now, Dr. MacDonald showed a much greater tendency to respond to things like movement and form than he did to color. So this is another way we might get from the tests support for the hypothesis that he really doesn't utilize his emotional responses very effectively. Another thing we score is the tendency to look at whole concepts as opposed to relatively small, detailed aspects of the blot. Captain MacDonald was much more inclined to look at small, teeny details. On some of the blots, he gave about 10 responses, and almost none paid any attention to the blot as a whole. Instead, he went around interpreting this little piece, that piece, a little piece here, a little piece there,